Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is By Design. Today, we're off to Tasmania to visit The Castle, a new form of affordable and mobile housing. We meet a book designer who became a cook, and we pay tribute to a designer who became a legend, Yves Saint Laurent, who died this week. How much of our built environment should be preserved for future generations? And who should decide what we keep and what we demolish? And who will pay the ever-increasing bills for what we used to call old buildings and have now learned to call heritage? These are some of the hard questions being asked by our first guest. He's Tony Gilmore. He lectures in heritage conservation at the University of Sydney, and he's the author of Sustaining Heritage, Giving the Past a Future. Tony, welcome to By Design.
Good morning, Alan.
Now, can I suggest that while most people might like to visit historic buildings, the term heritage listed strikes fear into the hearts of many private property owners?
Well, maybe for once I've got some good news for property owners, and they've had a lot of bad news recently. From the surveys I've seen, heritage listing tends to be thought to increase the value of properties. And in a survey a few years ago, some two-thirds of people said that the price would increase. And obviously that's going to affect the views of people who are potentially buying a heritage property. And if you look at an area like, say, Paddington in Sydney, which is now a conservation area, that was pushed for by the residents. It wasn't imposed on them by anybody from outside.
What about, does it affect what you can do with the building? I mean, I've heard from Will Alsop, the English architect who has a property in Rome, and I heard him give a talk, not in Rome, in Italy. In Italy, it's almost impossible to change anything. Partly it's a highly bureaucratized society. It's almost impossible to change anything in a heritage building.
There are certainly restrictions on what can be done with properties, and some countries are slightly more enforcing than others. One thing to think about, though, is although there might be some restrictions on what you can do with your property, there are also restrictions on what can happen in the neighbourhood. So it's some pain and some gain.
Australia has only two World Heritage listed buildings, the Royal Exhibition Building in Melbourne and the Sydney Opera House. But World Heritage listing is only one layer. It's the top layer of a complex system of heritage listing, isn't it?
It is. I mean, Australia's actually doing quite well on the World Heritage scores. In a sense, we've got 17 gold medals, 17 sites are listed, compared, say, to just under 30 in the United Kingdom. So we're doing quite well for international listings. But in our own country, the system is pretty Byzantine. There can be up to 10 different listings on a particular property. There are even two different national lists. There's a national list and a Commonwealth national list, various state and local listings and voluntary listings. And these all apply to the same property. It's not that you're on one list or you're on another. You can actually be on all of these lists.
It's odd that we should have so many in this country on the world sort of catalogue, given that we're one of the younger white settled countries in the world. I wonder why it is this a sop to Australian sensibilities by older countries?
You're right in terms of the imprint of white people in Australia. The number of listings is quite small, but of course we've got a wonderful natural environment.
Oh, indeed.
Many of those items are listed. And we also seem to be pretty good at understanding Indigenous heritage as well. And it was here that we pioneered the Burra Charter, named after a small town in South Australia, which is now the world standard in how you define cultural significance. So it's good that we've actually built on that Indigenous understanding.
Now, I know that you're very concerned about who decides whether a building is worth heritage listing, and to illustrate this, your book uses as a case study a building most people who have visited Sydney would be familiar with. What's the building and what's its story?
Well, it's actually called the Maritime Services Board Building, but most people probably know it as the home of the Museum of Contemporary Art on Circular Quay. It's kind of resplendent between the bridge and the Opera House, although itself it was an office building for government bureaucrats open in the early 1950s. And what happened in the 1990s was a whole series of debates came to the fore. It was when it was converted into a contemporary art gallery, it was said to be run as the most entrepreneurial art institution in Australia, therefore no public funding. So they had to really go hammer and tooth to get as much commercial income in as possible. And unfortunately, no one's ever managed to run an institution of this type and actually just get commercial funding in. So basically by the late 1990s, it had gone bust. It was bailed out for the Olympics, but after that, the politics started to take hold. And there was a very interesting dispute as to whether, when it was commercialised, in other words, office space rebuilt on the site and the income from that would be used to pay for the heritage conservation and the art gallery, what we'd do with it. One of the infamous proposals was to put the IKEA coffee table on the top, a wonderful kind of straight out of the catalogue table would have gone on the top. That would have been the gallery and the offices would have been beneath. But when, who's now the current planning minister, was involved from the City of Sydney, there was the proposal to demolish the building. And it was only at that stage that we actually had some sort of debate as to whether it was seen as being a heritage building. Up until that point, it wasn't significantly listed to protect it. And most people who'd seen the conservation management plan thought that it could either stay or that it could go. But we had a sort of trial by media, by tabloid media in many ways, public protests, a real issue as to what we should do with the building. But maybe for me it was less to do with the building itself, and it was the fact that we didn't want to have another toaster.
I got a bit of a soft spot for the building. So for people who don't know it, I should say that it's probably the world's youngest genuinely Art Deco building, because I think it sort of left the drawing board in the 30s, but as you say, wasn't open till the 50s. So it's an odd sort of thing, but I'm quite fond of it.
I think it does have some merits, and it certainly adds a bit of variety to the suite of buildings on Circular Quay. Whether it's Art Deco or not, it's got many of the strict classical features of fairly totalitarian buildings of the period. It doesn't particularly function well, I think, as a contemporary art gallery, just because of the space inside. So I think we ought to keep the fabric of the building, would maybe do something else on the site in addition to it as well.
Now, you talked about the sort of tabloid war and protests about this building. How can members of the public be given a stronger voice in deciding what is and what isn't listed? And in fact, do we want them to have a stronger voice, or do we want qualified architects and nobody else?
The more people that contribute to the debate, the better, from my perspective. The debate's been dominated by experts for a long time now, not always successfully. We mentioned that there's a Byzantine heritage listing structure in Australia. We need to review that. We need to still respect the balance between the Commonwealth and the states, but we need to review that system. Now, when England did that in 2003, there was a very extensive public consultation that took place. Lots of people were involved, and I think the process that came out was better. Now, another thing that England's done, which is through television, through the BBC there, is the programme Restoration. A certain amount of public money is allocated each year to renovate a worthy building or site around the country. And basically, each week there's an expose of these proposals, which brings in a lot of local support for these sites. And then the public vote, and the one that wins gets the money. But what's interesting is those that haven't won are also much more supported by the local community and often get financed through other sources as well.
What about the other cost of these buildings, the environmental cost of some of these buildings? Because they can be hugely expensive. I mean, obviously the embodied energy in the building, the energy that was put into actually constructing it, that's way in the past. We don't have to worry about that. But what about other factors?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it's not necessarily going to be as cost-effective to run heritage properties as it is a completely modern building, although there are some features, actually, of these old buildings, which are actually quite good for keeping them cool in the summer and warm in the winter.
Great buildings in Canberra like that, some government buildings,
Right. Yes, we'll have a lot of listings there in the years to come. But that's one of the reasons why we need to be fairly creative about thinking of different sources of finance to bring into the system, because there's a heritage time bomb building up, particularly with a lot of the buildings around the time of Federation. They were going to come through the system. So we may not have a huge amount of built heritage in Australia at the moment, but very soon we are going to, and that's when we have to find these extra sources of finance.
Something you seem to be particularly critical of, which is actually something I'm not very keen on either, is turning history into theme park, for example, by having people dress up as convicts and so on in an attempt to make a convict precinct a more entertaining experience.
I think there was a theme park called Old Sydney Town here, which interestingly failed a few years ago. So maybe that was one of the debates as to whether we do conservation or whether we do kitsch, and maybe that was a little bit more on the kitsch side. And perhaps a more successful example is Sovereign Hill in Ballarat in Victoria, which again has sort of relocated buildings from around the country and put them together in a recreation of an 1850s settlement. And there are some costumed actors going around to describe how life might have been there. My view is it can be done well or it can be done badly, and we're starting to get better at it as time passes. But what it does do is it kind of opens up heritage to maybe people who wouldn't always go there. And if you're taking young children around as well, you probably want to have something a little bit more entertaining than just a museum. So I think as part of the overall heritage environment, yes, one or two tasteful costumed theme parks are okay.
Well, in America, of course, you can go to 17th century places and hear people who are virtually living the 17th century and talk 17th century English as well.
Yeah, I wonder how much we impact on their culture by treating them as a heritage theme park, because that's a very living culture, which I think is quite powerful.
Tony, you do mention in the book a notable example of English heritage, namely Stonehenge. This looks so substantial that it's difficult to imagine what the issues are here, but there certainly are issues, aren't there?
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I find heritage interesting is because it's a forever contested area. I mean, you think about those old stones and think, well, what can the issue be? We just need to look after them and conserve them. But those stones have different meanings for different people. And they're now associated with Druids as much as with the ancient civilizations there. The Druids have been coming there since the first part of the 20th century. But in the 1970s, they were locked out, because it was considered they were not a tasteful addition to England's current heritage culture. But in many ways, they have become part of the heritage and traditions of that site as well. So one or two days a year, a few Druids in Stonehenge, that's fine by me.
Yeah, I think Druids, they're not real Druids. They're just theme park Druids. They just think they're real Druids. Tony Gilmore's book, Sustaining Heritage, Giving the Past a Future, is published by Sydney University Press. Tony, thank you very much. I'll let you get back to your heritage house in the Sydney suburb of Paddington. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Alan.
On ABC Radio National, you're with By Design, and coming up, a story that sounds as though it might be about heritage, but in fact isn't. The castle.
On Radio I this week, the story of a young woman who has a rare anxiety disorder that literally leaves her speechless.
When I try to speak, I freak out.
Except for immediate family, Elle communicates by writing notes or using a keyboard.
So why, when I'm at home, behind closed doors, can I speak like a normal girl?
Elle's story, this afternoon on Radio I. After the news at 2, here on ABC Radio National.
A shortage of affordable housing in Australia has placed a high number of Australians at risk of homelessness. Ballooning house prices and rents are pushing a lot of people out of their homes, into emergency shelters, or worse, onto the streets. Harry Tams, who's a youth worker in Launceston, knows the story all too well. That's why he's come up with an alternative, affordable and mobile housing option for the homeless. And fond of the proverbial expression about a man's home being his castle, Harry's called the idea the castle. The following feature takes us on a journey from the design phase to the actual building of Harry's beloved castle. It was produced for By Design by Helen Thomas-Joyce with the assistance of the ABC Regional Production Fund. Here's Helen.
"22,000 young Australians are homeless every night. They sleep on the street, at a friend's or relative's house, or if they're lucky, they find a bed at a homeless shelter. Harry Tams has been working with young people at risk of homelessness for more than 20 years. Based at Youth Futures, an emergency shelter in northern Tasmania, Harry says he has never been able to turn away anyone seeking shelter. But having faced some close encounters, Harry got serious about his idea of providing affordable housing options for young people who are homeless or who are at risk of homelessness. Harry approached the University of Tasmania School of Architecture and Design and StudentWorks, a school alternative where students at risk are taught technical trades, to become partners in the project. They were both very keen. Ian Clayton is a lecturer at the School of Architecture and Design.
When Harry walked in the door and we had a chat, I grabbed Robin, grabbed Richard, and I thought, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Oh, I said, we've got to do this one. We've got to do this one immediately.
Together they came up with a design brief. It would be mobile, autonomous, lean, and most importantly, it would be a home. The castle was built onto a trailer, so it could be transported to wherever it would be needed. Its size of 2.4 by 3.6 means it is quite small, but its generous height of 4 metres from ground level gives it the space that most small transportable homes lack. Harry Tams.
We do need to look at other options. And there's many, many people that are in a crisis situation that do not need supervised care in a congregate living situation like ours. And it would be really nice to be able to provide them with options such as the castle, which is just a little one-person dwelling.
It's late January 2008. 24 architecture students arrive for day one of the school's learning by making module, the Castle Phase 2. In the workshop sits a test rig that was the work of the Castle Phase 1 group. Their role was to explore the concept of the castle. Matt Broidy, a third-year architecture student who took part in the Castle Phase 1, explains.
What we came up with was what we called a test rig. So it was basically a box that can be expanded and contracted, and it's 4.8 metres long, which we decided was going to be the maximum length, and it's 2.5 metres wide, which is going to be the maximum width. And it had a variable height and internal lofts and things. And the idea of this was so that we could test the ergonomics of various things that we were going to include or exclude. So once we started installing bits of the kitchen or tables or chairs or things, we could get a feel for how they worked.
You were saying before about you don't want it to look like a caravan. You want it to be distinctly different. How did the group go about ensuring that?
Well, I guess it's one of those broad sort of architectural ideas, is the idea of home. And caravans come with the idea of holiday and the idea of something temporary. What we're trying to provide for young people in danger of homelessness is something that's secure and not temporary.
And what attracted you to doing the castle project? How does it feel to be working on a project that's addressing a social need?
I think there's no greater problem for architecture. I think there's all kinds of fantastic and wonderful things that architects do in making bridges and opera houses and skyscrapers and things. And
that's all well and good
and makes a lot of people happy, but the basic human needs of shelter is a real challenge.
One of the conversations that took place in the beginning stages of the castle project was the idea of home. The challenge, though, was making a space the size of a small garden shed and one which is mobile into a home. Richard Burnham, lecturer at the School of Architecture and Design.
Just the fact that it's so small questions a lot of our preconceptions as to what home is. The fact that it's on wheels and potentially can site itself in a dense urban setting or out in the bush or on a beach block also questions a notion of home. So how it might or might not fit in with those different settings. But I think the most important thing that we're trying to get across is that this is, it may be an extreme option in terms of its size, but it is nevertheless important to have alternatives. The mainstream notion of what our culture sees as home is fairly one-dimensional, probably becoming even more blinkered and even more narrow in terms of what we see home being. So one of our roles is to try and point out that there are alternatives.
Harry Tams.
Every person has a different idea of what home is. Some people consider home a fireplace, another person may consider it a gable end, and someone else would think that a porch is required. Others like things that are quite minimal, others like buildings that are totally cluttered. I think that there's been an effort to make it a home, but again, it's subjective. It's just taste, really. I imagine you need to sleep in it, you need to cook in it, you need to lounge in it, and you know, it's all the things that one does within a home that makes it a home. So will this building allow me to do those things? And I think the castle will be a very livable place.
Nicholas was kicked out of home 4 weeks ago. He is 17 years old. He found a bed at one of Launceston's emergency shelters, Youth Futures.
That's Dane's room. This used to be my room. It's room 5. So you got laundry, another tour, another bathroom. We mainly use this bathroom. And my room now, that used to be mine, but it's Dwayne's now. And this is probably the biggest room they have.
Okay.
It's like the only one with these kind of windows, the rest is real small. It's on that side of the building. Like, it's still a bit messy, but yeah, I have a habit of that.
So when you got, like, this is actually what you came with?
Yeah, all this stuff is pretty much what I have. Yeah, 2 bags, backpack, drawers, and all that shit over there. CDs, DVDs in the box.
So you had issues with your father?
Yes, last 5 years pretty much, even though I lived with him for free. So still don't talk to him anyway. I just annoy the hell out of him.
And what kind of abuse was it from your stepmother?
Physically, like, she'd come into my room and start attacking me, and only like once she came in and started pulling on my hair, and Dad grabbed her and threw her at the door. But later on I had to apologise, and I didn't even do anything. I was just sitting there watching a video or drawing on the computer or something.
Lecturer Richard Burnham says enshrined in the United National Covenants is the right for everyone to have access to adequate housing. He says the castle will not be for everyone, but it may be the solution for some. The students are being briefed on day one of the castle project. Richard Burnham and Ian Clayton.
It's the role of schools of architecture to question what's going out there, what's going on out there in the mainstream building industry. And as Harry said, there are very few options when it comes to affordable housing. So this is a fairly radical departure from the norm, but we feel it is our responsibility, and that there's no reason, particularly in the current climate of the lowest affordability on record, why the castle would only be attractive to homeless kids. We see the market eventually being much wider, and we definitely don't want to, design and construct the castle with a homeless youth image. We want it to be to be capable of being seen by the wider population as being a desirable way of living. Simple, small, but still desirable.
That's the hardest adventure in architecture, by the way. How can architecture make people smile, laugh, sigh, walk towards and want to be, or cry or shout? And I think the first team have done a fabulous job as setting the blank canvas for you.
It's not long and the students are underway building and testing panels, which will form the structure of the building. Over the next 3 days, the students explore design options, the placing of windows, bathroom setup, sleeping space, storage, and an outdoor area. Consensus is reached on certain design elements of the castle at a team meeting.
If everyone agrees that this wall becomes the kitchen and storage with that shelving and all that complexity, we give that one a tick. Good. We give a tick to this side being habitable. And making a strong connection with the front. Is that a tick?
Yep. Yeah.
That's a tick. Right, good. Do we give the wet area people a tick? Right.
Consensus on the roof design requires a little bit more discussion time. The team take a vote and the off-centre gable wins over the standard gable roof. By day 9, the castle is starting to take shape. Plywood flooring is fixed directly onto a double-axle galvanised steel trailer. Structurally, the castle is composed of two bookends, one at the front and one at the rear. The rear bookend contains the bathroom and a raised platform, around the size of a double bed. The front bookend includes a single-bed loft platform. Cabinet work joins the two down at floor level, and a sliding ladder rolls from one end of the building to the other, so you can access either loft space. Considering the castle's size, the design aspects give it an air of spaciousness. On the second last day, a crane is ordered to lift the roof onto the castle. And for the first time, the team's vision of what the castle would look like is realised.
It feels...
I reckon I could live in this.
That's the weakness.
Fantastic, mate.
It's pretty good.
Great roof.
Feels very comfortable.
This is better than most people's bedrooms.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, yeah.
It's
bigger too, much, much bigger. Yeah.
You could definitely sleep up there, angle.
That's a really big space up there.
Robin Green, the school's workshop manager, Guy, a student who worked on the castle, and Lynn Andrews, coordinator at Student Works, speak about what the castle means to them.
It's almost like a little baby house, but it's not quite. And it's all, and the door, a door that occupies half the front with this big generous landing that you step up onto it and then you walk through it and the whole, basically the whole thing opens up and you walk in and then you've got seating and you can climb up to this loft. And as I'm looking through there now, there's feet hanging down and it's just like you can imagine that a group of people could sit in there and find a way to live in there quite happily. You know, like, and the conversations jumping around the room from people on both sides and down at the bottom and somebody cooking on the stove and people sitting out on the deck. And so you can see all of those things happening quite easily. And as a way people can just appropriate the whole thing. Yeah, I find it amazing.
When we were designing, it was we'd all throw our ideas out on the table, and people would just jump in with ideas and go, "Oh, what if we do this? Or what if we do this?" And that's what happened with this window here and the door. The door was created like someone goes, "Oh, what if the door just pivoted in the middle?" And so they're like, everybody's like, "Yeah, that's a great idea. Let's do that." Or, "What are we going to do with this side of the caravan or this side of the castle?" And they're like, "Oh, how about a bay window? How about joinery?" And we're like, "Well, let's do that." So we modelled it up. and drew it up, and here we are sitting in the bay window.
It's a real hope to the reality of homelessness. It's not about finding a box to put somebody in. It's actually about a real solution. It's about making people believe that they are in charge of their destiny.
The Castle Project will now enter its next stage. The Tasmania School of Architecture and Design, with input from Youth Futures and Student Works, will design and build the second prototype, incorporating lessons learnt from the Castle Phase 2. A mini architecture practice will be set up within the School of Architecture and Design to work with long-term development of the castle. For every 5 castles that are made to order commercially, 1 will be made from the profits and given to Youth Futures to be used by young people who are homeless or who are at risk of homelessness. In the meantime, the Castle Phase 2 team continue to be inspired by their efforts of what they hope to be a solution for at least a small portion of young people who need a place to call home.
It's the generosity I find really empowering in the whole thing. Like, you look at the front door and it's just not like any other caravan you'll ever see. You look at the back and it's just not like anything else you'll ever see. And you say that, you go inside and it's just not like anything else you'll ever be in. And I think it's just all come together. And it's that realisation of all those ideas.
Robin Green from the University of Tasmania. And that feature on The Castle, an affordable and mobile housing option for the homeless, was produced with the assistance of the ABC Radio Regional Production Fund. And you can see images of the castle at various stages of its development on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. Next, trends and products. This week on Trends and Products, a salute to one of the 20th century's greatest trendsetters. Nearly 20 years ago, the heroine of Fabulous Nobodies, the Australian writer Lee Tulloch's lovely book about a girl who's in love with her clothes, introduced herself like this: "My name is Reality Nirvana Tuttle, and I was born in 1968. 1968 was one of the great years in modern history. It was the year Yves Saint Laurent shocked the fashion world with his first see-through blouse. Well, that's how important Yves Saint Laurent, who died earlier this week in Paris, was to some people. And to talk about him, I'm joined now in our Sydney studio by David Marr, author of Fashion Speak. David, welcome.
Thank you.
David, let's begin with pants for women. Most of the women at Yves Saint Laurent's funeral mass, including Carla Bruni, the wife of President Sarkozy, were dressed in trouser suits as a tribute to him. He made it acceptable, indeed desirable, for women to wear sexy pantsuits. We can talk about this in a second, but first, he really was a key person behind the concept, which we now take for granted, of ready-to-wear, prêt-à-porter, wasn't he? He wanted to take fashion to, if not to the masses, certainly to a larger number of people.
Well, I mean, he really invented the concept of ready-to-wear. I mean, before he did, in 1966, he opened his first Rive Gauche store, which is what he called his ready-to-wear stores, after the Left Bank of Paris and the kind of alternative culture that it was known for. But previous to that, you know, a fashion designer was a couturier, which was a kind of a custom-made sort of business. And he really came up with this idea of wanting to make clothes for the masses. And, you know, at one point he had 160 Yves Saint Laurent Rive Gauche stores, which when they started were selling dresses for $60 in 1966, which is not $60 now, but that's still a lot less than you would have paid for an Yves Saint Laurent designed couturier item.
And this became a global brand.
Absolutely. I mean, he really was one of the first who had a concept of this idea of the global brand, where he had fragrances. He even had a brand of cigarettes at one point. He appeared himself in his own fragrance ads and so on. And he really kind of created that very first sort of lifestyle brand, which is what most fashion brands aspire to be today.
Yeah, I suppose he'd been slightly he was coming slightly after Coco Chanel here, of course, who had done the perfumes, the famous Chanel No. 5 and so on.
Yeah, I mean, fragrance were always a part of, certainly for a long time of the 20th century, fragrance were a part of a fashion business. But he sort of took that one step further and, you know, had these kind of Rive Gauche stores sort of filtered down, as well as, you know, just filtering down the kind of the essence of Coco Chanel to a fragrance. He took it to a line of clothing that more people could buy, that was more in tune with the sort of the average wearer.
But the introduction relatively recently of ready-to-wear, this shows how radical a designer can be, how a designer really can be a sort of leader of cultural trends.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, really, it's probably, I think, of all the designers of the 20th century, it's he and Chanel who, moved fashion beyond being merely aesthetic and beyond creating merely sort of beautiful dresses and beautiful clothes. And, they penetrated sort of social territory, and they responded to how women particularly, the role of women was changing and how they wanted to wear.
And he took his lead from the market. He did have his eye, as you say, on what women wanted to wear, on what people wanted, rather than what he wanted to impose upon them, didn't he?
And the pants thing in 1968 is very much a part of that. I mean, that collection that you mentioned in your introduction, the 1968 collection with the see-through blouses, was his first collection where he launched what he called City Pants, and there was a whole lot of different styles of trousers for women. And he sort of made them, tried to feminize them a bit with things like see-through blouses. And, there's this great quote from him where he says, and he was always very self-deprecating, and he said, "My small job as a couturier is to make clothes that reflect our times. I'm convinced that women want to wear the pants."
And this reflected, of course, a change in women's role in society, which by no means yet complete. Just ask Hillary Clinton. But it meant that women were going into the workforce. They were starting to wear the pants, as it were.
Yeah, and it was the beginning of the feminist revolution. And, in 1966, he had his Le Smoking collection, which was a sort of a take on the traditional men's tuxedo jacket. And he often incorporated elements of a traditional man's wardrobe, such as a safari jacket as well, into his collections. And that collection was made very famous by a series of photographs by Helmut Newton. And what was interesting about those photographs is the androgynous look of the models and in their clothes. And he really did sort of tread that line between male and female, but at the same time tried to create a very new female aesthetic from that.
Now, revolutionary is a tricky word to use, but he was always trying to create new ways of seeing. You've mentioned Chanel, but Dior and Chanel made their names with a look. Yves Saint Laurent was able to capture a lot of attention because he was exploiting different looks. It was a pragmatic way of capturing the press and the eye of the fashion world. That's what made him thoroughly a product of the late 20th century, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, his look was a dramatic new statement each season. So, his hemlines went up and down. And what that did was it made him a sort of a darling of the press, because the press had something to report each season, and he would shock them. I mean, they weren't always well-received collections, but what he became known for was the unexpected. So at each one of his collection shows, people would go there thinking, what has he done now, rather than just seeing a variation on a theme that they might have seen the season before. I mean, of course, towards later in his life and his later collections, he did sort of just revisit his greatest hits in a way. But in the 60s and 70s, that's what he became known for and became a darling of the press around the world.
Do you think there's a downside to that if we think in terms of his heritage? I mean, is the downside a certain hyperactivity in the fashion world these days, a change for change's sake?
Well, it is. I mean, I think a lot of designers do struggle with reinventing the wheel each season and trying to create something that gets exciting. And also the part of the problem, I think, in a way, with ready-to-wear, which is how most designers work these days, is that it becomes dependent on sales volume and growth and so on. And the only way you can do that is to convince customers that they need something new each season. There's no point in putting out classics each season, because presumably you don't need to buy more of them. So they do get kind of caught up in this cycle of having to be new each season from a business point of view, but also from a critical point of view.
Well, this is one of those very rare funerals where you'd see all those women in pantsuits. So is it his contribution, his sartorial contribution to social change in the 70s for which he will be remembered, do you think?
I think so. And I think if you look at what Carla Bruni wore to the funeral, I mean, that's kind of the quintessential Yves Saint Laurent look, the sort of the tuxedo-style jacket and tailored pants for women who can go somewhere. I mean, what he did was he put women in pants but made them no less feminine and made them equally no less elegant than what they would be in a traditional sort of woman's dress from the time. And I think that's what he'll be remembered for.
Well, is this a look that would have softened up Hillary Clinton a bit, do you think?
Well, there are people I read in the New York Times, they said that Hillary Clinton's style of wearing pantsuits owes a lot to what Yves Saint Laurent did in the 60s and 70s. So,
well, that's something we can thank him or blame him for. David Marr, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Coming up, book design and Italian food. And to take us there, some Italian music performed this week at the funeral of Yves Saint Laurent, Vivaldi's Stabat Mater. Guy Mirabella was born in Melbourne and now lives on the Mornington Peninsula with his family and cooks at Shop 8, that's A-T-E, cafe and store in Mount Eliza. But he's also spent much of his life as a designer and a teacher of design, and as a graphic designer, he's been responsible for a lot of cookbooks, as well as writing quite a few. He joins us now on the line from Melbourne. Guy, welcome to By Design.
Good morning, Alan.
Your new book is called Eat, Eight, A-T-E again. Did you design this one yourself?
No, I didn't. The book was designed by Dominic Hofstadter. I mean, there was initial concepts done as a submission to the publisher months before Dominic did come on the scene, and there are quite a few elements of that in the design, but really the credit should go to Dominic, I think.
I think it's fair to say it's a highly designed book. Can you just describe us to us what it looks like?
Well, the book is a mixture, I guess, of obviously the food shots have to be in there, but there's also paintings. There's photographs of a container, for instance, you know, with all the rust on page 124. It's opposite a photograph of a camellia. All full page. There are also there's a book within a book, if you like. There's some smaller pages that are sewn in between the sections of the book that have the stories or the moments that I remember. They also have food shots or shots of a family wedding or group shots of a couple with young children.
And these little inserted smaller pages, it's like finding letters preserved within the pages of a book. And in fact, the typography is like an old Remington typewriter,
isn't
it?
That's right, yeah. Mm. We had to somehow come up with a way of not letting those stories get lost within the pages of the food shots. And because normally with cookbooks, it's just food and recipes after one another, I felt that the pages of the stories would get lost and no one would read them. So what mechanism can we use to make these, you know, perhaps stop the reader a little bit and get them to sit down and read those stories? And I guess the idea came from Mary Small, the publisher. She had a Hugo Boss catalogue, of all things, and the catalogue was made up of large format pages, but inserted within them were these tiny little cards, if you like. sewn into the binding. So as soon as we saw that, I said, well, that's it. That's the idea we should use for this one.
I have to say, though, that despite the beauty of your book, in fact, because of the beauty of your book, I do wonder whether I want it in my kitchen. It doesn't look like something I want to get splashed or greasy. So as somebody who's designed a number of cookbooks, can you say, is it possible for a cookbook just to be too beautiful and stylish?
No, of course not. I mean, I'm flicking through mine now, and it's got those little yellow tags on it. There's blue tags on it. There's green tags. I found some dried fennel in the middle of the page with pasta de verdura. It's got stains on it. It's beautiful. I love the stains. I think it should be a working book. But isn't it lovely to be able to have it as a working book, but also look so beautiful? And it's not just for the coffee table.
Yes, Gay Bilson was very pleased that I'd managed to, when she signed her book for me, she was very pleased that I managed to get blood all over it. it was actually my blood, but that's another story. It's easy, perhaps it's too easy, too cheap to make comparisons between designing and cooking. But your food is Italian, and Italian food seems to me to be about sensuality and flavour rather than appearance. But do you see any connection between your work as a designer and your work as a cook?
Look, I do. I've always communicated, if you like, in quite a visual way, and that's what gets my senses going first, I suppose, and that's looking at something visually. It could be anything. And when I am preparing in the cafe, I tend to almost start at the end and see how it's going to look on the plate and then work my way backwards. Of course, the flavours of the food have to just sing and be beautiful in your mouth once you're tasting it. But, you know, because sometimes we can get a bit too overboard and mix things that shouldn't really be mixed. But I do tend to start in a visual way, and I guess it's not because of my background in graphic design, but as a child I can always remember being stimulated by something visually, always.
On ABC Radio National, you're with By Design, and I'm talking to a designer who became a cook, but is still a designer, Guy Mirabella, about his new book, Eat Eight. Guy, this book is organised by themes, isn't it, rather than, say, courses or ingredients?
That's right. It's in the themes of extravagance, generosity, love, tradition, life and food. And I just felt by doing it in the traditional way, it just didn't seem to me, anyway, the way that I felt about this project. And it came about quite by accident, in that I remember years ago when I dedicated Pastro Basta, I think it was, to my parents, I thanked them for extravagance, generosity and love and tradition, et cetera, et cetera. And I was going back to the earlier books to try and see how can I connect this one to those other ones, which, you know, there was about a 15-year gap between those last books, and I wanted this book to be more of a new beginning. And I felt that grouping these recipes under those titles, which was a much more evocative, if you like, or a kind of connection from the last books.
Your first chapter is devoted to extravagance, which you celebrate with reference to Giuseppe di Lampedusa's great novel, The Leopard. I noticed, by the way, that the book has some shots of what I assume are your bookshelves, and the leopard is on one of them, and Visconti's film of it, and there's also a book about Visconti on another of your shelves, I noticed. But of course, the meal in... there's a great meal in The Leopard, and also a great ballroom scene. But you say that the true secret of extravagance is generosity. But that, in fact, is the title of your second chapter.
It's the second chapter, yeah. I guess to be... to do things in an extravagant way, you have to also be very generous in the way that you deliver that. And it was quite... I can remember when titling these two chapters, really, that, you know, they should probably be the one chapter. But you can see extravagance in a very kind of visual way. It's all there laid before you. But underneath all of that, I think it's the generosity that's being conveyed that you have to understand, and it's in the it's in the feeling of extravagance that you get that generosity, if you like. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
No. Yeah, I do. I do know what you mean. I'm also fascinated that your chapter on love is devoted to pasta.
All of it, of course, because I love pasta. And I could eat it every day for lunch, you know, if I had to. And it seemed to me the obvious choice of recipes, you know, to put them in. And I don't know. We ate a lot of pasta when I was young, of course, and you know, it's just such a beautiful and easy meal to prepare, and it can be very, very simple, you know, like... just grating some zucchini, some lemon zest, you know, a little bit of garlic, and that's it. Or then you can complicate it. Well, not complicate it a little bit, but you can, you know, probably be a little bit more extravagant with it by adding, you know, some chopped walnuts or chopped hazelnuts, or sometimes what we do in the restaurant, you know, we'll add a roasted pumpkin to that or peas. You know, it's pasta. I mean, you can do amazing things, and then there's the different types of pasta.
I was pleased to see that you end your book in a way that not enough cookbook writers do. You encourage your readers not to follow the recipes. Why is that?
Well, you know, I mean, I just felt at the end of the day, how I'm telling you to make a dish is fine. It's just it's the bones. It's a guide. I don't know how you eat at home, and there are preferences that you may have, and you may think, well, no, he's not quite right there. Why don't I put in more raspberries or more blueberries or more of this or more of that? And I guess what I'm trying to say, or what I'm trying to encourage people to do, is to be their own cook, if you like, and just take these as a guide.
And very briefly, we learn from the book that this Queen's Birthday long weekend, most of your family are going to be barracking for Collingwood, but not you.
No, unfortunately, my team this year is right at the bottom of the ladder. And instead of going to the ground this year, we're all assembling at the house. So,
okay. Well, have a good and mournful time.
Thank you, Alan.
Been talking to Guy Mirabella, whose book Eat Eight is published by Hardy Grant. Guy, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Details of Guy's book, pictures of the castle and much else on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. And that's also where to go for details of our podcasts, or to write to us about anything you've heard on the show or anything that's on your mind. By Design is produced by Mark Wakeley and Jan Ryan, with technical production this week by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Alan Saunders. I'll be back next week.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online. with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.